welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and as they say on late night TV, we've got a really big show. We'll be previewing books cited on all the key literary lists as the biggest titles of fall 2013. Stephen King, Malcolm Gladwell, Elizabeth Gilbert, fiction, nonfiction, and short stories. This autumn holds something special for every book lover, and I'm so pleased to be your guide. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Stephen King returns to the characters and territory of one of his most popular novels, The Shining. In the instantly riveting Dr. Sleep, the now middle-aged Dan Torrance must save a very special 12-year-old girl from a tribe of murderous paranormals. A tribe of people called the True Knot travel in search of sustenance. They look harmless, mostly old, married to their RVs. But as Dan Torrance knows, the True Knot are quasi-immortal, living off the steam children with The Shining produce when they are slowly tortured to death. Dan has been drifting for decades, desperate to shed his father's legacy of despair, alcoholism, and violence. He has settled in a New Hampshire town and found an AA community that sustains him. His job at a nursing home allows him to offer up his remnant shining power as a final comfort to the dying. Aided by a prescient cat, he becomes Dr. Sleep. When Dan meets Abra Stone, he recognizes her spectacular gift, the brightest shining ever seen. Dan's own demons are reignited as he battles for Abra's soul and survival. Will Patton narrates this gory, glorious story of the epic war between good and evil.
Wendy Torrance and her son received a settlement from the corporation that owned the Overlook. It wasn't huge, but enough to get them by for the 3 years she was unable to work because of back injuries. A lawyer she consulted told her that if she were willing to hold out and play tough, she might get a great deal more because the corporation was anxious to avoid a court case. But she, like the corporation, wanted only to put that disastrous winter in Colorado behind her. She would convalesce, she said, and she did, although back injuries plagued her until the end of her life. Shattered vertebrae and broken ribs heal, but they never cease crying out. Winifred and Daniel Torrance lived in the Mid-South for a while, then drifted down to Tampa. Sometimes Dick Halloran, he of the powerful hunches, came up from Key West to visit with them, to visit with young Danny especially. They shared a bond. One early morning in March of 1981, Wendy called Dick and asked if he could come. Danny, she said, had awakened her in the night and told her not to go in the bathroom. After that, he refused to talk at all. 3. He woke up needing to pee. Outside, a strong wind was blowing. It was warm. In Florida, it almost always was, but he did not like that sound, and supposed he never would. It reminded him of the Overlook, where the defective boiler had been the very least of the dangers. He and his mother lived in a cramped second-floor tenement apartment. Danny left the little room next to his mother's and crossed the hall. The wind gusted, and a dying palm tree beside the building clattered its leaves. The sound was skeletal. They always left the bathroom door open when no one was using the shower or the toilet because the lock was broken. Tonight the door was closed. Not because his mother was in there, however. Thanks to facial injuries she'd suffered at the Overlook, she now snored, a soft queep, queep sound, and he could hear it coming from her bedroom. Well, she closed it by accident, that's all. He knew better. Even then, he was possessed of powerful hunches and intuitions himself. But sometimes, you had to know. Sometimes, you had to see. This was something he had found out at the Overlook, in a room on the second floor. Reaching with an arm that seemed too long, too stretchy, too boneless, he turned the knob and opened the door. The woman from room 217 was there, as he had known she would be. She was sitting naked on the toilet, with her legs spread and her pallid thighs bulging. Her greenish breasts hung down like deflated balloons. The patch of hair below her stomach was gray. Her eyes were also gray, like steel mirrors. She saw him, and her lips stretched back in a grin. "Close your eyes," Dick Halloran had told him once upon a time. "If you see something bad, close your eyes and tell yourself it's not there, and when you open them again, it will be gone." But it hadn't worked in room 217 when he was 5, and it wouldn't work now. He knew it. He could smell her. She was decaying. The woman, he knew her name, it was Mrs. Massey, lumbered to her purple feet, holding out her hands to him. The flesh on her arms hung down, almost dripping. She was smiling the way you do when you see an old friend, or perhaps something good to eat. With an expression that could have been mistaken for calmness, Danny closed the door softly and stepped back. He watched as the knob turned right, left, right again, then stilled. He was 8 now and capable of at least some rational thought even in his horror, partly because in a deep part of his mind he had been expecting this. Although he'd always thought it would be Horace Derwent who would eventually show up, or perhaps the bartender, the one his father had called Lloyd. He supposed he should have known it would be Mrs. Massey, though, even before it finally happened, because of all the undead things in the Overlook, she had been the worst.
That was Dr. Sleep by Stephen King. Elizabeth Gilbert was born in Connecticut and grew up on her family's small Christmas tree farm. She attended New York University, where she studied political science by day and worked on her short stories by night. After college, she spent several years traveling around the country, working in bars, diners, and ranches. These explorations eventually formed the basis of her first book, a short story collection called Pilgrims. During her early years in New York, she also worked as a journalist for such publications as Spin, GQ, and the New York Times Magazine. She was a 3-time finalist for the National Magazine Award, and an article she wrote in GQ about her bartending on the Lower East Side eventually became the basis for the movie Coyote Ugly. In 2000, Elizabeth published her first novel. Other books followed, but she is, of course, best known for her 2006 memoir, Eat, Pray, Love. The book sold over 10 million copies and was made into the beloved movie with Julia Roberts. The title became so popular, Time magazine named Elizabeth as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. In 2010, Elizabeth published a follow-up to Eat, Pray, Love called Committed, a memoir which explored her ambivalent feelings about the institution of marriage. And now we have the signature of all things, a sprawling tale of 19th century botanical exploration. Ready for some backstory? I know I am. Welcome, Elizabeth. So wonderful to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back and always happy to be here.
The Signature of All Things is your first novel in 13 years. Were you terrified that your fans were waiting for another memoir?
No, I'm not terrified of my fans. I'm really fond of my fans, and I wanted to write a book that they would love in maybe a different way, a different kind of journey. It's more of an invitation to my fans than it is a response or a rebuke. They are all very, very, very welcome to come with me on this trip as well.
And it's a wonderful trip. I love the book. Your main character, Alma Whitaker, is a botanist, and you grew up on a Christmas tree farm. What are we to make of this? Is Alma based in part on you?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, whenever you're writing fiction, your characters come from you. So even if you're inventing them and making them up, they still have parts of your DNA and your fingerprints and your bits of yourself hidden in there.
Well, tell us some more about her. She's fascinating.
Oh, well, I'm glad you think so. Alma is the daughter of a guy that I invented named Henry Whitaker, who was a great botanical explorer of the 19th century. And she grows up in this rarefied world in Philadelphia with this extremely wealthy family and an incredibly intellectual mother. She's very overeducated, exposed from an early age to all kinds of ideas and all kinds of scientific notions, and she becomes, not surprisingly, a scientist in her own right. I think of Alma as a tree among flowers. At a time when women were meant to be sort of dainty and invisible, she is a towering presence intellectually and emotionally and even physically.
I love that phrase. Alma is an adventurer, and in the 19th century, she was really a rarity. How difficult was it to place her, because I think of her as almost a modern woman, in the early 19th century?
Well, you would be surprised, actually. She's not as big an anomaly as you may think.
All right.
In many ways, there were many women quite like Alma. Many compared to what we write about, which would probably be zero. but botany was the only science that was readily open and welcoming to women in the 19th century, because I like to think that women snuck into the field of botany through the garden gate. Gardens have always been women's domain, and so women were permitted sort of accidentally to participate quite thoroughly in the botanical world. And there were some really adventurous botanical explorers who were women, and Alma's life, while her own, I didn't base her exactly on somebody, bears resemblance to a good number of very intrepid and bold female explorers.
You know, I'd love you to talk a bit about your research for this book. It is so vast in scope.
Well, I'll tell you, I was so daunted by the scope of what I was taking on. You know, I really wanted to write a book that would be, how can I say this? I wanted to write a big, sweeping epic. And I wanted to write the kind of books that I love to read, you know, something with those galloping 19th century narratives that span decades and include interconnected intergenerational families. And I also wanted to write a book of ideas about science and about botany and about women's place in the world and the changes that were happening in the 19th century. So in order to do all that, I spent 3 years doing research for this novel, 3 years of mostly reading just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books, not only about botany, but about common people's lives during that time, reading letters and journals to sort of capture the language. And then I did a lot of travel for it, too. I went as far away as French Polynesia to make sure that I got the Tahitian part of the novel correct, and also went to London to study Darwin's papers at Kew Gardens and to the Hortus Botanical Gardens in Amsterdam, and, of course, all over Philadelphia, where a good part of the novel is set, to make sure that I had the historical settings correct. So it was a lot of work, but that's the kind of work that I consider fun.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed every minute of it.
The way that you write the dialogue, it instantly conjures up an earlier time. For example, Alma's mother scolds her by saying, quote, "No outbreak of jealousy or malice has ever been welcomed in God's eyes, nor shall an outbreak ever be welcomed in the eyes of your family. If you have sentiments within you that are unpleasant or uncharitable, let them fall stillborn to the ground." How are you able to capture this tone?
Well, Beatrix was really fun to write. That's Alma's stern Dutch mother, who has lots of speeches like that because she spends her life arduously correcting her daughters and trying to make them... Her biggest fear is that she's going to have daughters who are foolish idiots. So she spends her entire life making sure that they won't be, and that they be respectable, responsible, intelligent people. And you know, that those kind of things, you can find that language in early in 18th and 19th century etiquette books. You know, they have that sort of stern tone where the author of the book is admonishing you in advance for sort of failing to be as decent a human being as you should be. So I think I got some inspiration from those.
And how did you come up with the title, The Signature of All Things?
Well, The Signature of All Things is actually an existing theory that was posited by a German mystical botanist in the 16th century, a fellow named Jacob Bohm, who believed that God had hidden in the design of every plant on Earth some secret clue in its organization.
And also, the book has some romance in it as well.
It does. And I don't want to spoil it too much by discussing the love story, but I will say that it has a very unusual and surprising love story.
Yes, that's true, readers. All right.
And I will not ruin any of those surprises by saying another word about it.
Nope, we don't tell.
except that I hope that it pulls at your heart.
I did. Is your next project already bubbling around in your brain?
It is, although I have to keep having conversations with it, explaining to it that I'm not going to be able to write it right now because I'm taking its sister, The Signature of All Things, on a book tour.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to be able to do any writing, but I do have an idea, and I'm really excited about it, and it's sort of fermenting as we speak.
Well, I've so enjoyed our conversation today. Do you have any final thoughts you want to share?
Oh, just that, you know, I hope that readers will take this book in the spirit in which it was written, which was a spirit of delight. I've never had more fun in my entire life than I had writing this book, and I hope that enthusiasm shows on the page and becomes infectious and that the reader feels it as well.
It does. You know, I want to let readers know that, yes, you know, there is a lot of, quote, science in the book, but it's a real page-turner. You want to know what happens with the people.
I'm glad to hear that. I wanted it to be, read like a Dickensian serialized novel, where there's a pace that just sort of thrums throughout the whole book, and that's what I was aiming for. So I'm delighted to hear that you had that reaction to it.
And I was delighted to read every page. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Always a delight to talk to you.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of The Signature of All Things, narrated by Juliet Stevenson.
Alma instructed Hanneker to move Mr. Pike out of the guest wing and into Prudence's old bedroom on the second floor of the house, directly across the hall from Alma's own room. Hanneker protested the incursion of a stranger into the family's private living quarters. It was not proper, she said, nor safe, and most especially, we do not know him. But Alma overruled her, and the move was made. Alma herself cleared space for Ambrose in the carriage house, in a disused tack room next to her own study. Within a fortnight, his first printing presses had arrived. Soon after that, Alma purchased for him a fine bureau escritoire with pigeonholes and stacks of broad, shallow drawers to hold his drawings. "I've never before had my own desk," Ambrose told her. "It makes me feel uncharacteristically important. It makes me feel like an aide-de-camp." A single door separated their two studies, and that door was never closed. All day long, Alma and Ambrose walked back and forth into each other's rooms, looking in on the other's progress, and showing each other some item or other of interest in a specimen jar or on a microscope slide. They ate buttered toast together every morning, had gypsy lunches out in the fields, and stayed up late into the night helping Henry with his correspondence or looking over old volumes from the Whiteacre Library. On Sundays, Ambrose joined Alma for church with the dull, droning Swedish Lutherans, dutifully reciting prayers alongside her. They spoke, or they were silent. It did not seem to matter much one way or the other. But they were never apart. During the hours that Alma worked in the moss beds, Ambrose sprawled out on the grass nearby, reading. While Ambrose sketched in the orchid house, Alma pulled up a chair beside him, working on her own correspondence. She had never before spent much time in the orchid house, but since Ambrose's arrival, it had been transformed into the most stunning location at Whiteacre. He had spent nearly 2 weeks cleaning each of the hundreds of glass panes so that sunlight entered in crisp, unfiltered columns. He mopped and waxed the floors until they glittered. What's more, and rather astonishingly, he spent another week burnishing the leaves of every individual orchid plant with banana peels until they all shone like tea services polished by a loyal butler. "What's next, Ambrose?" Alma teased. "Shall we now comb out the hair of every fern on the property?" "I do not think the ferns would object," he said. In fact, something curious had occurred at Whiteacre right after Ambrose brought such shine and order to the orchid house. The rest of the estate suddenly seemed drab by comparison. It was as though someone had polished only a single spot on a dingy old mirror, and now, as a result, the rest of the mirror looked truly filthy. One wouldn't have noticed it before, but now it was obvious. It was as though Ambrose had opened an inlet to something previously invisible, and Alma could finally see a truth she would otherwise have been blind to forever. Whiteacre, elegant as it was, had incrementally fallen into a state of crumbling neglect over the past quarter century. With this realization, Alma got it in her mind to bring the rest of the estate up to the same sparkling standard as the orchid house. After all, when was the last time every single pane of glass in any of the other greenhouses had been cleaned? She could not recall. There was mildew and dust everywhere she looked now. The fences all needed whitewashing and repair. Weeds grew in the gravel drive, and cobwebs filled the library. Every rug needed a stout banging, and every furnace was in need of overhaul. The palms in the great glasshouse were nearly bursting through the roof. They had not been cut back in so many years. There were desiccated animal bones in the corners of the barns from years of marauding cats. The carriage brass had been allowed to tarnish, and the maids' uniforms appeared to be decades out of date. Because they were.
We've just heard The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert. By Thomas Pynchon brings us to New York City in the early days of the internet. It's 2001, in the lull between the collapse of the dot-com boom and the terrible events of September 11th. Silicon Alley is a ghost town. Google has yet to have an IPO, and Microsoft is still considered the evil empire. There may not be as much money around as there had been at the height of the tech bubble, but there's no shortage of swindlers looking to grab a piece of what's left. Maxine Tarnow is running a nice little fraud investigation business on the Upper West Side, chasing down different kinds of small-scale con artists. She used to be legally certified, but her license got pulled. Now she follows her own code of ethics. She carries a Beretta and does business with sleazebags when she so desires. When Maxine starts looking into the finances of a computer security firm and its billionaire geek CEO, things begin rapidly to jam onto the subway and head downtown. Jenny Berlin narrates.
The solipsism of infancy, the sexual hysterias of adolescence and entry-level adulthood, the paranoia of middle age, the dementia of late life, all working up to death, which at last turns out to be sanity. Great time to be finding that out, Freud flicking cigar ash at Kugelblitz and ordering him out the door of Bergasse 19, never to return. Kugelblitz shrugged, immigrated to the U.S., settled on the Upper West Side, and built up a practice, soon accumulating a network of high and mighty who in some moment of pain or crisis had sought his help. During the fancy-schmancy social occasions he found himself at increasingly, whenever he introduced them to one another as friends of his, each would recognize another repaired spirit. Whatever Kugelblitzian analysis was doing for their brains, some of these patients were getting through the depression nicely enough to kick in startup money after a while to found the school and to do Kugelblitz in on the profits, plus creation of a curriculum in which each grade level would be regarded as a different kind of mental condition and managed accordingly. A loony bin with homework, basically. This morning, as always, Maxine finds the oversized stoop aswarm with pupils, teachers on wrangler duty, parents and sitters, and younger siblings in strollers. The principal, Bruce Winterslow, acknowledging the equinox in a white suit and Panama hat, is working the crowd, all of whom he knows by name and thumbnail bio, patting shoulders, genially attentive, schmoozing or threatening as the need arises. Maxie High, Verva McElmo, gliding across the porch, through the crowd, taking much longer than she has to. A West Coast thing, it seems to Maxine. Verva is a sweetheart, but not nearly time-obsessed enough. People been known to get their Upper West Side mom cards pulled for far less than she gets away with. "I'm like in another scheduling nightmare this afternoon," she calls from a few strollers away. "Nothing too major." "Well, not yet anyway, but at the same time..." "No prob. Just to speed things up a little, I'll bring Fiona back to our place. You can come get her whenever." "Thanks. Really. I'll try not to be too late." She can always sleep over. Before they got to know each other, Maxine would bring out herbal tea after putting on a pot of coffee for herself, till Verva inquired, pleasantly enough, "Like I'm wearing California plates on my butt, or what?" This morning, Maxine notes a change from the normal weekday throw-together, what Barbara used to call an executive lunch suit instead of denim overalls, for one thing, hair up instead of in the usual blonde braids, and the plastic monarch butterfly earrings replaced by what? Diamond studs? Zircons? Some appointment later in the day? Business matters, no doubt? Job hunting? Maybe another financing expedition? Verva has a degree from Pomona, but no day job. She and Justin are transplants. Silicon Valley to Silicon Alley. Justin and a friend from Stanford have a little startup that somehow managed to glide through the dot-com disaster last year, though not with what you'd call irrational exuberance. So far, they've been coming up okay with the tuition and Kugelblitz, not to mention rent for the basement and parlor floors of a brownstone off Riverside, which the first time Maxine saw, she had a real estate envy attack. "Magnificent residence," she pretended to quell. "Maybe I'm in the wrong business." "Talk to Bill Gates here," Verva nonchalant. "I'm just hanging out, waiting for my stock options to vest. Right, honey?" California sunshine, snorkel deep waters, most of the time anyway. Once in a while, though, Maxine hasn't been in the business she's in for this long without growing antennas for the unspoken.
That was Bleeding Edge by Thomas Pynchon. From Pulitzer Prize winner Jhumpa Lahiri comes an extraordinary new novel, The Lowland, set both in India and America. It's the tale of two brothers bound by tragedy, a fiercely brilliant woman haunted by her past, a country torn by revolution, and a love that lasts long past death. Born just 15 months apart, Subhash and Udayan Mitra are inseparable brothers, often mistaken for one another in their Calcutta neighborhood. But they are opposites, with gravely different futures ahead. It is the 1960s, and Udayan finds himself drawn to a rebellion to eradicate inequity and poverty. He will give everything, risk all, for what he believes. Subhash, the dutiful son, does not share his brother's political passion. He leaves home to pursue a life of scientific research in a quiet coastal corner of America. When Subhash learns of the tragedy that befell his brother, he goes back to India, hoping to pick up the pieces of a shattered family. Sunil Malhotra narrates.
Since childhood, Subhash had been cautious. His mother never had to run after him. He kept her company, watching as she cooked at the coal stove or embroidered saris and blouse pieces commissioned by a lady's tailor in the neighborhood. He helped his father plant the dahlias that he grew in pots in the courtyard. The blooming orbs, violet and orange and pink, were sometimes tipped with white. Their vibrancy was shocking against the drab courtyard walls. He waited for chaotic games to end, for shouts to subside. His favorite moments were when he was alone, or felt alone, lying in bed in the morning, watching sunlight flickering like a restless bird on the wall. He put insects under a domed screen to observe them. At the edges of the ponds in the neighborhood, where his mother sometimes washed dishes if the maid happened not to come, he cupped his hands in turbid water, searching for frogs. He lives in his own world. Relatives at large gatherings, unable to solicit a reaction from him, sometimes said. While Shubash stayed in clear view, Udayan was disappearing. Even in their two-room house, when he was a boy, he hid compulsively, under the bed, behind the doors, in the crate where winter quilts were stored. He played this game without announcing it, spontaneously vanishing, sneaking into the back garden, climbing into a tree, forcing their mother, when she called and he did not answer, to stop what she was doing. As she looked for him, as she humored him and called his name, Shubash saw the momentary panic in her face that perhaps she would not find him. When they were old enough, when they were permitted to leave the house, they were told not to lose sight of one another. Together, they wandered down the winding lanes of the enclave, behind the ponds and across the lowland, to the playing field where they sometimes met up with other boys. They went to the mosque at the corner to sit on the cool of its marble steps, sometimes listening to a football game on someone's radio, the guardian of the mosque never minding. Eventually, they were allowed to leave the enclave and to enter the greater city, to walk as far as their legs would carry them, to board trams and buses by themselves. Still, the mosque on the corner, a place of worship for those of a separate faith, oriented their daily comings and goings. At one point, because Udayan suggested it, they began to linger outside Technician's studio, where Satyajit Ray had shot Pother Panchali, where Bengali cinema stars spent their days. Now and then, because someone who knew them was employed on the shoot, they were ushered in amid the tangle of cables and wires, the glaring lights. After the call for silence, after the board was clapped, they watched the director and his crew taking and retaking a single scene, perfecting a handful of lines. A day's work devoted to a moment's entertainment. They caught sight of beautiful actresses as they emerged from their dressing rooms, shielded by sunglasses, stepping into waiting cars. Udayan was the one brave enough to ask them for autographs. He was blind to self-constraints, like an animal incapable of perceiving certain colors. But Shubash strove to minimize his existence, as other animals merged with bark or blades of grass. In spite of their differences, one was perpetually confused with the other, so that when either name was called, both were conditioned to answer. And sometimes it was difficult to know who had answered, given that their voices were nearly indistinguishable. Sitting over the chessboard, they were mirror images, one leg bent, the other splayed out, chins propped on their knees. They were similar enough in build to draw from a single pile of clothes. Their complexions, a light coppery compound derived from their parents, were identical. Their double-jointed fingers, the sharp cut of their features, the wavy texture of their hair.
We've just heard The Lowland by Jhumpa Lahiri. In high school, David Epstein wondered whether the Jamaican-Americans who excelled on his track team might carry some special speed gene. In college, he ran against Kenyans and wondered whether endurance genes might have traveled with them from East Africa. At the same time, David noted that his team's training group of five could run next to one another, stride for stride, day after day, and nonetheless turn out five entirely different runners. How could this be? In The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance, Sports Illustrated senior writer David Epstein ponders whether stars like Usain Bolt, Michael Phelps, and Serena Williams are genetic freaks.
Or are they simply normal people who overcame their biological limits through sheer force of will and obsessive training? In the decades since the sequencing of the human genome, researchers have slowly begun to uncover how the relationship between biological endowments and a competitor's training environment affects athleticism. Sports scientists have entered the era of modern genetic research. Epstein, who narrates, tackles the great nature versus nurture debate and traces how far science has come in solving this riddle.
The American League team was deep in a hole, and National League slugger Mike Piazza was up to bat, so they called for the ringer. Sauntering past a phalanx of the world's best hitters, Jenny Finch strode toward the sun-drenched infield, her flaxen hair blazing in the clear desert light. For the previous 24 years, the Pepsi All-Star Softball Game had been an event contested by Major League Baseball players only. The crowd thrummed with excitement as the 6'1" Team USA softball ace reached the pitcher's mound and curled her fingers around the ball. It was a temperate day in Cathedral City, California, 70 degrees in the replica of one of America's own sports cathedrals. The 3/4 scale imitation of the Chicago Cubs' Wrigley Field was faithful in its ivy-covered outfield walls. Even Wrigleyville's brick apartment buildings were there, in the desert at the foot of the Santa Rosa Mountains, depicted on near life-size vinyl prints created from photographs of Chicago. Finch, who in a few months would win a gold medal at the 2004 Olympics, had originally been invited only as a member of the American League coaching staff. That is, until the American League Stars went down 9-1 in the 5th inning. No sooner did Finch arrive at the mound than the defensive players behind her sat down. Yankees infielder Aaron Boone took his glove off, lay down in the dirt, and used second base for a pillow. Texas Rangers all-star Hank Blaylock took the opportunity to get a drink of water. They had, after all, seen Finch pitch during batting practice. As part of the pregame festivities, a raft of Major League stars had tested their skill against Finch's underhand rockets. Thrown from a mound 43 feet away and traveling at speeds in the upper 60-mile-per-hour range, Finch's pitches take about the same time to reach home plate as a 95-mile-per-hour fastball does from the standard baseball mound, 60 feet and 6 inches away. A 95-mile-per-hour pitch is fast, certainly, but routine for pro baseball players. Plus, the softball is larger, which should make for easier contact. Nonetheless, with each windmill arc of her arm, Finch blew pitches by the bemused men. When Albert Pujols, the greatest hitter of a generation, stepped forward to face Finch during pregame practice, the other major leaguers crowded around to gawk. Finch adjusted her ponytail nervously. A wide smile stole across her face. She was exhilarated, but also anxious that Pujols might hit a line drive right back at her. A silver chain dangled over his expansive chest, his forearms as wide as the barrel of the bat. "All right," Pujols said softly, indicating he was ready. Finch rocked back and then forward, whipping her arm in a giant circle. She fired the first pitch just high. Pujols lurched backward, startled at what he saw. Finch giggled. She unleashed another fastball, this time high and inside. Pujols spun defensively, turning his head away. Behind him, his professional peers guffawed. Pujols stepped out of the batter's box, composed himself, and stepped back in. He twisted his feet into the dirt and stared back at Finch. The next pitch came right down the middle. Pujols uncoiled a violent swing. The ball sailed past his bat, and the spectators hooted. The next pitch was way outside, and Pujols let it go. The one after that was another strike, and Pujols whiffed again. With one strike remaining, Pujols moved all the way back to the back of the batter's box and dug in, crouching low in his stance. Finch rocked and fired. Pujols missed badly. He turned and walked away toward his tittering teammates. Then he stopped, bewildered. Pujols turned back to Finch, doffed his cap, and continued on his way. "I don't want to experience that again," he later resolved. So the defensive players behind Finch had good reason to sit down in the field when she entered the live game. They knew there would be no hits. Just as she had during the pregame practice, Finch struck out both hitters she faced. Piazza struck out on 3 straight pitches. San Diego Padres outfielder Brian Giles missed so badly on the 3rd strike that his momentum spun him through a pirouette. And then Finch returned to her role as a ceremonial coach. She was, though, not nearly finished befuddling major leaguers. In 2004 and 2005, Finch hosted a regular segment on Fox's This Week in Baseball, in which she would travel to major league training camps and transform the best baseball hitters in the world into clumsy hacks.
That was The Sports Gene by David Epstein. Malcolm Gladwell, best-selling author of The Tipping Point, Blink, and Outliers, offers his most provocative book to date. 3,000 years ago on a battlefield in ancient Palestine, a shepherd boy felled a mighty warrior with nothing more than a stone and a sling. Since then, the names of David and Goliath have stood for battles between underdogs and giants. David's victory was improbable. He should not have won. In David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants, Gladwell, who narrates, challenges how we think about obstacles and disadvantages, offering new interpretation of what it means to be discriminated against, or cope with a disability, or lose a parent, or suffer from any number of setbacks. Gladwell begins the story of what really happened between the giant and the shepherd boy. From there, he examines Northern Ireland's troubles, the minds of cancer researchers and civil rights leaders, murder and the high costs of revenge, and the dynamics of successful and unsuccessful classrooms, all to demonstrate how much of what is beautiful and important arises from what looks like suffering and adversity.
But the shepherd was adamant. He had faced more ferocious opponents than this, he argued. When the lion or the bear would come and carry off a sheep from the herd, he told Saul, I would go after him and strike him down and rescue it from his clutches. Saul had no other options. He relented, and the shepherd boy ran down the hill towards the giant standing in the valley. Come to me that I may give your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, the giant cried out when he saw his opponent approach. Thus began one of history's most famous battles. The giant's name was Goliath. The shepherd boy's name was David. 2. David and Goliath is a book about what happens when ordinary people confront giants. By giants, I mean powerful opponents of all kinds, from armies and mighty warriors to disability, misfortune, and oppression. Each chapter tells the story of a different person, famous or unknown, ordinary or brilliant, who has faced an outsized challenge and been forced to respond. Should I play by the rules or follow my own instincts? Shall I persevere or give up? Should I strike back or forgive? Through these stories, I want to explore two ideas. The first is that much of what we consider valuable in our world arises out of these kinds of lopsided conflicts, because the act of facing overwhelming odds produces greatness and beauty. And second, that we consistently get these kinds of conflicts wrong. We misread them. We misinterpret them. Giants are not what we think they are. The same qualities that appear to give them strength are often the sources of great weakness. And the fact of being an underdog can change people in ways that we often fail to appreciate. It can open doors and create opportunities and educate and enlighten and make possible what might otherwise have seemed unthinkable. We need a better guide to facing giants, and there is no better place to start that journey than with the epic confrontation between David and Goliath 3,000 years ago in the Valley of Elah. When Goliath shouted out to the Israelites, he was asking for what was known as single combat. This was a common practice in the ancient world. Two sides in a conflict would seek to avoid the heavy bloodshed of open battle by choosing one warrior to represent them in a duel. For example, the 1st century BCE Roman historian Quintus Claudius Quadrigarius tells of an epic battle in which a Gaul warrior began mocking his Roman opponents. This immediately aroused the great indignation of one Titus Manlius, a youth of the highest birth, Quadrigarius writes. Titus challenged the Gaul to a duel. He stepped forward and would not suffer Roman valor to be shamefully tarnished by a Gaul. Armed with a legionary shield and a Spanish sword, he confronted the Gaul. Their fight took place on the very bridge over the Anio River, in the presence of both armies, amid great apprehension. Thus they confronted each other, The Gaul, according to his method of fighting, with shield advanced and waiting an attack. Manlius, relying on courage rather than skill, struck shield against shield and threw the Gaul off balance. While the Gaul was trying to regain the same position, Manlius again struck shield against shield and again forced the man to change his ground. In this fashion, he slipped under the Gaul's sword and stabbed him in the chest with his Spanish blade. After he had slain him, Manlius cut off the Gaul's head, tore off his tongue, and put it, covered as it was with blood, around his own neck. This is what Goliath was expecting, a warrior like himself to come forward for hand-to-hand combat. It never occurred to him that the battle would be fought on anything other than those terms, and he prepared accordingly. To protect himself against blows to the body, he wore an elaborate tunic made up of hundreds of overlapping bronze fish-like scales. It covered his arms and reached to his knees and probably weighed more than 100 pounds. He had bronze shin guards protecting his legs with attached bronze plates covering his feet. He wore a heavy metal helmet. He had 3 separate weapons, all optimized for close combat. He held a thrusting javelin made entirely of bronze, which was capable of penetrating a shield or even armor. He had a sword on his hip, and as his primary option, he carried a special kind of short-range spear with a metal shaft as thick as a weaver's beam.
We've just heard a sampling of David and Goliath by Malcolm Gladwell. Tom Perrotta's 9 Inches features short stories focusing on the author's familiar suburban nuclear families. Perrotta's first book, Bad Haircut, consisted of linked stories featuring a shared protagonist. Now, 19 years later, the stories, performed by an ensemble cast, focus on the fissures in families and unexpected connections among members of typical American communities. The stories showcase Perrotta's assured, smooth writing. For example, the smile on Happy Chang's face was the Boston Book Festival's first One City, One Story selection.
I'd applied to 12 institutions of higher learning and got rejected outright by 10 of them, including my safeties. I got waitlisted by 2 of my likelies, but neither one came through in the end. I got shot out, just like the kid in Accepted. Except it was nothing like that, because he was a slacker and didn't deserve to get in. I totally deserved it. I mean, I got a combined 2230 on the SATs, super scored, but still, and had a GPA of 3.8, all honors and APs, top 10% of my graduating class in one of the premier public high schools in the state. Student council rep, stagehand for the musicals, helped start a recycling program in the cafeteria. I ran cross-country all 4 years, even though I hated every tedious mile. But I did it just so I could list a varsity sport on my transcript. Every goddamn miserable thing I ever did, every shortcut I avoided, every scrap of fun I missed out on, I did it just so I could get into a decent college. And none of it mattered. My guidance counselor insisted that it was just a freak occurrence, a perfect storm of bad luck and rotten demographics. A record year for applications, too many international students, preferences for minorities and athletes, a need for geographic diversity, blah, blah, blah. But come on, not to get in anywhere? Even when kids from my own high school with lower grades and test scores got into colleges where I was rejected? Where's the fairness in that? There was no logical way to explain it, but that didn't stop people from trying. Maybe I was too well-rounded for my own good, or my recs were underwhelming. Maybe my essay was pompous, or maybe it was pedestrian. Maybe I hadn't done enough to set myself apart from the crowd. Should have written about my lifelong passion for shoemaking, or my desire to someday design prosthetic limbs for transsexuals who'd stepped on landmines. Or maybe I just aimed a little too high, which was possibly true for Dartmouth and Brown. But those were my reaches, so that's the whole point. But what about Connecticut College or George Washington? Was that really too much to ask? April of senior year was such a nightmare. Everybody else was all excited, hugging one another and squealing with delight. The future unfolding before their eyes. Colgate, Hampshire, UVM. and then they'd notice me and everything would get all awkward and quiet, almost like somebody in my family had died. People just kept moaning and shaking their heads, telling me how sorry they were, how unfair it was, a complete injustice that shook their faith in the entire system, and I kept telling them not to worry. I'm on the wait list at Duke and Grinnell, I'd say. I'm sure something will pan out. The second time Lieutenant Finnegan pulled me over, just a week after the first incident, he was all business. He took my license and registration, went back to his car, and wrote me a ticket for failure to obey a traffic sign, a moving violation punishable by a $100 fine. Oh, come on, I said. $100? That's crazy. You have the right to contest this citation in the district court, he informed me in a robotic voice. The lights on the police cruiser were flashing lazily, the whole neighborhood pulsing with red. Should you choose to do so, you must notify the court of your intention within 20 days. I didn't reply, because there was no point in going to court. I definitely rolled through the stop sign. I wasn't about to deny it, but I thought he could cut me a little slack. It was 10:30 at night, and I was driving on a quiet side street out by the conservation land. I'd just made my final delivery, a lousy $1 tip, thank you very much, and there was no one else around. No one except for Lieutenant Finnegan, hiding on the dark street with his lights turned off. Shit, I muttered. I can't believe this. Excuse me? Lieutenant Finnegan shined his humongous flashlight in my face. What did you say? I raised my hand to block the glare. Nothing. I was just talking to myself.
That was 9 Inches by Tom Perrotta. Readers, the bountiful crop of new fall releases holds so much promise. To see what other new titles from favorite authors are on their way, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.